Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Danielle, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Progress in the Treatment of Indolent Non-Hodgkin Lymphoma. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of the collaboration and your interest in this topic that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 887 participants on the call, and you come from all of the United States. And we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, Egypt, Ireland, Pakistan, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Today's activity has been made possible by Teva Pharmaceuticals, and I really want to thank them for their support of the program today. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about all of our collaborating organizations as a resource for you. There also is information about our speakers and the topics they'll be addressing. And there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. You know, your recommendations to us and suggestions really help us to keep these programs most relevant to meet your needs. Today's topic was one that many of you had recommended, and so here it is. Please do let us know the topics of interest to you. We were actually talking a bit before the call started. There are many, many different types of lymphoma, and I know that many of you have particular interests and are offering particular programs. Please let us know what you'd like us to offer, and we will do our very best to offer the programs that you request. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Oliver Press. Dr. Press is member Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, recipient Dr. Penny E. Peterson Memorial Chair for Lymphoma Research, professor of medicine at University of Washington, co-chair of NCI Lymphoma Steering Committee. And Dr. Press is going to address an overview of indolent non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, novel treatment approaches, the benefits of communicating with your healthcare team, and key questions to ask your doctor. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Press.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today and to be able to talk a little bit about progress in the management of indolent lymphomas. I'm going to begin by just some general comments on lymphoma and then narrow in on the indolent lymphomas. As most of you probably know, lymphomas are cancers of lymph node cells, and the main type of cell that involves a lymph node is called a lymphocyte. Lymphocytes are made in two places, in the bone marrow, and those are called B lymphocytes or B cells, and in the thymus gland in the neck, and those are called T lymphocytes and T cells. But as soon as they're made, lymphocytes leave the bone marrow and the thymus, and they migrate all throughout the body where they try to find and kill foreign invaders like bacteria, viruses, or indeed cancer cells themselves. And they do most of that work in collections of lymphocytes throughout the body called lymph nodes. We all have hundreds of lymph nodes throughout our body. They're generally small, though, 1 centimeter in size or smaller generally. But they get big either when they're fighting an infection, doing their work, or the lymph node cells, like any other cell in the body, can undergo a malignant transformation in which a mutation occurs, a change in the chromosomes or the genes, which confers a growth advantage on the mutated cell. And so what happens is that the mutation originally happens just in one lymphocyte, but then it outgrows or outsurvives all the normal lymphocytes. And over time, the malignant transformed cells replace and outgrow the normal cells. And then you get an enlarged lymph node, which becomes a lymphoma. And because the job of lymphocytes is to migrate through the body, it doesn't take long, and you have malignant cells in the lymph nodes all over the body. Lymphoma is a pretty common disease. Between 70 and 80,000 Americans a year get lymphoma, about 70,000 non-Hodgkin lymphomas, and about 8,000 to 9,000 Hodgkin lymphomas. And there are about 500,000 Americans currently living with lymphoma. Lymphoma is a very complicated field because there are many, many mutations that can give rise to lymphoma, and each of those has a different behavior. So there are more than 60 kinds of lymphomas. And to make things a little simpler, we divide the lymphomas up into different groups. And about half of the lymphomas are very slow-growing, what we call indolent or low-grade, and that's the topic of today's conference. But then there are another half or so of the lymphomas which grow much faster and are called aggressive, and those can be either intermediate or high-grade lymphomas. And that's a topic of another conference sometime, but today we're going to focus on the indolent, low-grade, or slow-growing lymphomas. The most important test in making a diagnosis of lymphoma is a lymph node biopsy. And because there's so many types and the treatments for each type differ, it's critically important to get the right diagnosis at the beginning. And that's why lymphoma experts nearly unanimously agree that the initial biopsy for lymphoma should be a good chunk of tissue, either in taking out a whole lymph node or at minimum a generous core biopsy of a lymph node. And just skinny needle aspiration biopsies or fine needle aspirations are really inadequate and shouldn't be used to make the initial diagnosis. Once the type of lymphoma is diagnosed, then additional tests like CAT scans, PET scans, bone marrows, blood tests, etc., are done to determine how far the lymphoma has spread, because in order to pick the best treatments, we really need to know both the type of lymphoma and its distribution, also known as the stage of the lymphoma. Now, if we turn to therapy, it's important to recognize that the treatment for lymphomas is generally different than for other cancers. For most solid cancers, like lung cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer, surgery usually plays a major, if not the most important role, and if you can cut out a solid tumor before it's spread, you can often cure it. But since lymphomas are generally all throughout the body, surgery doesn't really work very well for lymphomas. Similarly, radiation treatments, which are usually local, have a relatively limited role in lymphoma. And the main treatments are those that we inject or take by as pills by mouth and that go throughout the body. And so for years, chemotherapy has been the major treatment for lymphomas, although that is now changing. Indolent lymphomas, which is the topic today, comprises several different subtypes. The most common is called follicular lymphoma, which is about 25% of all the non-Hodgkin lymphomas in the United States. But there are also small lymphocytic lymphoma, about 6% of all lymphomas, marginal zone lymphomas, lymphoplasmacytic lymphomas, and several other subtypes. They all share the characteristic that they grow very slowly, and most patients have few, if any, symptoms at the time they're diagnosed. Now, curiously, when we talk about therapy, it's often not necessary to treat at all for a while, sometimes for many years after the diagnosis, because studies have shown that survival isn't necessarily improved by beginning treatment immediately. So if a patient doesn't have symptoms, has a relatively small lymph node burden, and is doing well, often the medical oncologist or hematologist will merely do what's called watchful waiting or observation or expectant therapy, surveying the patient and how they're doing, and making a determination about whether treatment needs to be started or not. And I've had patients I've followed in my clinic for more than 20 years and never treated with indolent lymphomas, and many of them are doing just as well today as they were 20 years ago. However, at least the majority of patients will eventually need treatment. And there are a set of rules that we use to decide when to begin some form of treatment. And those are if the patient has symptoms, like drenching night sweats, profound fatigue, weight loss, pain, or if the lymph nodes are getting so big that they're pushing on normal organs and causing problems, like obstructing the kidneys or obstructing the outflow of the liver, anything like that would cause us to want to treat. And there are many effective forms of treatments now. The standard treatment, when treatment is required these days, involves giving a monoclonal antibody called rituximab, which sticks to and kills malignant B lymphocytes, the most common form of lymphoma. And usually rituximab is given along with some chemotherapy regimen. Right now, for indolent lymphomas, the most common regimen involves rituximab and a chemotherapy drug called bendamustine. But other popular regimens include R-CHOP, rituxan along with four drugs, Cytoxan, Adriamycin, Oncovin, and Prednisone, RCVP. So there are a variety of different rituximab plus chemotherapy regimens, which are all very effective. And the vast majority of patients, when they're given these treatments, will see their lymph nodes shrink and go into what we call remission. And those remissions often last many years, but eventually most patients with indolent or slow-growing lymphomas will have the lymph nodes regrow and need treatment again. However, survival with indolent lymphomas is usually outstanding, and we expect patients with indolent lymphomas to live decades after the diagnosis. In some cases, we apply what's called maintenance rituximab, where we give a dose of rituximab every 2 or 3 months for 2 years after the end of chemotherapy to try to prolong the remission duration, and that's a very popular and successful strategy. There are also lots of exciting new treatments which are now out, and those include pill forms, ibrutinib, idelalisib, and a compound called ABT-199. They're all new biological therapies that aren't really chemotherapy themselves, but show really exciting activity. And I think the future of treatment for indolent lymphomas is going to be using these new oral agents, which have fewer side effects than the old chemotherapy drugs. And we're still learning how to use those in the best combinations, but the next few years will be very exciting. There also are antibody drug conjugates, where we actually connect a chemotherapy drug onto an antibody and target it directly to the indolent lymphoma cells, and those are also showing outstanding activity. And there are new immunotherapies, they're so-called CAR T-cells, where we actually modify a patient's own T-lymphocytes so that it can recognize and kill lymphoma cells better. Those are still highly investigational, but very exciting treatments. So those are some of the most exciting new developments in the treatment of indolent lymphomas. I'm also supposed to talk a bit about how to communicate with your healthcare team. It's very important that you talk to your doctor, the nurse, the dietitian, et cetera, to understand your disease, which type of lymphoma you have, because when patients don't understand the diagnosis and the treatment, there often is anxiety and depression. You should understand the choices of different treatments. There are many acceptable choices for indolent lymphomas, and you want to know about the possible side effects. You want to know about the trials, because many of the most exciting drugs and best drugs can only be obtained these days on clinical trials until they're FDA approved. And you want to know the side effects. And increasingly, you want to know the cost. How much are these new drugs going to cost you? Because most of them are exorbitantly expensive, and coverage varies tremendously from one patient to the next based on your plan. So when you meet with your physician, there are several key questions you want to ask. You want to ask about the type of lymphoma you have, how far it's spread, namely the stage, the treatment options. You want to talk about the side effect profiles, the financial implication, the clinical trials that are available, and the prognosis or outlook for your lymphoma. So I'm going to stop there to allow time for Dr. O'Connor, but thank you for attending this teleconference today.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Press. That was really excellent and just an outstanding overview of indolent non-Hodgkin's lymphoma with a lot of information. I know there'll be a lot of questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Owen O'Connor. Dr. O'Connor is Professor of Medicine and Experimental Therapeutics, Director, Center for Lymphoid Malignancies, Department of Medicine, Co-Director, Program of Lymphoid Development and Malignancies, Herbert Irving Comprehensive Cancer Center, Columbia University Medical Center, the New York Presbyterian Hospital. And Dr. O'Connor is going to address the role of clinical trials, how research contributes to your treatment options, your comfort level with adherence, managing treatment side
effects. I want to thank you for joining us today on this Cancer Care teleconference, and I'd like to once again thank Carolyn and Cancer Care for their sponsorship of these very important, informative teleconferences. And I think Dr. Press gave you a very, very nice overview of indolent non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and how we think about many of the new treatments that are now on the horizon. What I'm going to try and do for the next 10 or 15 minutes is talk to you a little bit about the role of clinical trials and how research can contribute to your treatment options. And I'd like to discuss about how patients should approach clinical trials in terms of honest questions to ask your doctor and the healthcare team, and how to think about managing side effects. And we'll end by talking a little bit about some of the new treatments that are on the horizon. First, I want to point out that when many patients think about clinical trials or hear about clinical trial, their first instinct is to say, well, I'm no guinea pig. I'm not an experimental subject. There's no way you're going to put me on a trial so I can be a subject for your experimental investigation. And nothing could be further from the truth. The types of training that all physicians and healthcare professionals need to undergo in order to be able to conduct clinical research in the United States is extraordinary. And the regulatory oversight at the level of the federal government, at the level of the individual institution, and sometimes the National Cancer Institute is really extraordinary and all designed to make sure that it protects your best interests so that, in fact, you are not treated, nor should you ever feel, like an experimental subject. In fact, when I think of clinical trials and I think of the many opportunities afforded by clinical trials, I think I recognize these trials as really important opportunities in your care. And the simple way that I look at it is that, as we just heard from Dr. Press, there are lots and lots of options for these diseases. And every single one of those options that Dr. Press discussed in terms of the conventional standards of care, at some point in their history, used to be a clinical trial. And one way to think about these diseases is to think about them as chronic diseases. So if you have so many conventional therapies available to you to manage the disease over your expected lifespan, and you now have a variety of new drugs being vetted or studied in clinical trials, the way to think about it is that these new drugs being studied in clinical trials represent new opportunities to try to manage your disease without using many of those conventional therapies that you heard about before. And I think when you look at the clinical trials that are being published today for these diseases, the response rates for many of these new drugs as single agents without chemotherapy are many times in the 50, 60, 70, and 80% range. They're extraordinary responses, complete remissions, and durations of remission. So I actually think of all clinical trials as being important tools to help the doctor manage your disease for an even longer period of time. The next thing a lot of patients worry about when they hear about clinical trials is, no, you're not going to get me to get a placebo. And it is exceedingly rare in hematologic malignancies, in fact, across all of oncology, to use placebo-controlled clinical trials. In almost every case, many of these trials are being studied without a comparator arm. We'll talk about the types of trials and the need for a comparator arm in a few moments. But for most of these trials, you're not getting a placebo, and being even considered for randomization to a placebo arm is not even a part of most clinical trials that are now actively ongoing for the study of these diseases. So I would encourage you to have a very open dialogue with your physician any skepticism and curiosity about clinical trials that you might bring into the dialogue, be open about it, and learn from the physician and learn from the many websites that are now available to you from various organizations like the National Cancer Institute, Lymphoma Research Foundation, and Leukemia Lymphoma Society, which really have good narratives informing you about the nature of clinical research. Well, one of the first questions to ask when you're thinking about clinical trials is, well, what kind of clinical trial are you referring for me? And you need to recognize that clinical trials typically come in one of three flavors: phase one, phase two, and phase three. The phase one clinical trials are usually what we call the first-in-human studies of a new drug that's coming along, and you need to recognize that those drugs that make it to a phase one clinical trial represent very, very promising agents that we think are going to make an impact on the management of a particular patient's disease. So just because it's phase one doesn't necessarily mean that it's not worthy and it's not going to have potential value. When you look at the response rates in many phase one clinical trials for patients with lymphoma, the response rates are pretty high, in the order of 30 to 50% for many of these studies. But phase one studies typically start with a lower dose of a drug, and they're designed to answer two questions. What's the maximum tolerated dose of this drug that I can give to the patient, and what are the associated toxicities of this drug in a particular patient population? So they're what we consider to be dose-finding kinds of studies, and they're very important in trying to refine and define the best way to give these drugs to patients so that they have minimal side effects with the optimal opportunity for benefit. Well, phase two trials are a little bit different. If the phase one trial tries to answer the question, what's the best dose to give to a patient, the phase two trial tries to answer the question, what's the benefit of this drug in a defined patient population? So in a phase two trial, the dose of the drug is defined, and all the patients get treated at the same dose on the same schedule with that drug, and they all have comparatively about the same disease, and you treat all those patients identically, and then ask the question at the end of the day, what was the response rate? What was the complete response rate? What was the duration of the remission, and what was the progression-free survival on that study? So phase two studies are a little bit more advanced, and they're specifically designed to answer the question, what's the optimal merit, what's the optimal benefit of this particular drug in a very particular patient population? Well, many drugs that get approved by the FDA, in fact, are approved off phase two data. But the FDA would really like us to have randomized phase three data on all the drugs that they actually wish to approve. But sometimes when you have very, very rare diseases, like we have in the treatment of many blood cancers like lymphoma and leukemia, it's very hard to do randomized studies. So randomized studies are designed to answer the question, is this new therapy or this new drug better than what we do as the current standard of care? So if the current standard of care might be CHOP-R-based chemotherapy, and the randomized phase three trial then would ask the question, is this new therapy of ABC any better or equivalent or inferior to the standard therapy of R-CHOP? And those randomized studies are typically done as part of the requirement to meet an FDA approval for some drugs that are approved in the phase two setting. In many solid tumor malignancies, like in breast cancer and lung cancer, where there are lots and lots of patients, many drugs tend to get studied in randomized phase three studies a little bit sooner. So all of these types of trials do offer a benefit, and I would not try to read between the lines and say, well, you know, this isn't going to work, or it's a phase one study, I'm not likely to derive benefit. The reason we're doing the study is because we actually don't know the answer to those questions, and it's very, very important to consider clinical trials as an important piece of your total care, because they really do help us try to figure out down the road the best way to manage these sometimes complicated diseases at a time when we do have a lot of new ways to consider treating the disease. I think it's very important for every patient to recognize that when you're treated on a trial, that you always have the right to ask the physicians and your healthcare team any question that you feel is appropriate about the conduct of the study, about the terms of the study, about toxicities and benefits seen in other patients. It's also important for you to recognize that you can come off a clinical trial at any point you desire. So if you're not comfortable in the clinical trial, you don't need any reason. You can come off on your own will. Now, typically, physicians will, and your healthcare team may consider taking a patient off the clinical trial if they believe that the patient is experiencing untoward toxicity that they don't think is appropriate. If they think that the patient's disease is growing on the clinical trial, they can take you off because it's not helping you. And if they think that the patient is not being compliant with the terms of the trial, which is extremely important today given all of the regulatory oversight, the physician, it's at the physician's discretion to potentially take a patient off a trial. And just as the physician has that discretion, you too as a patient have the discretion to be able to remove yourself from that clinical trial without prejudice, without bias, and without fear of reprisal, still expecting the same kind of high-quality health care that you expect from your healthcare team. And you should feel very, very comfortable and not at all worry about hurting anybody's feelings because you're not comfortable and you want to come off. But I would argue that if you so choose to do that, do it in the context of an informed dialogue with your physician. I think whether you're getting treated on a clinical trial or you're getting treated with conventional therapy, it is really paramount across all of medical oncology to manage side effects. Our ability to manage side effects is really paramount in our ability to try to achieve the most optimal results for any given patient. Obviously, if you can't stay on a drug therapy, it's not going to help you. So what many patients don't realize is that they have toxicities that can be readily managed. And for as much as medical oncologists talk about advances in cancer therapy, there have been just as many, if not more, advances in how we treat the adverse effects of many drugs. So this dialogue is very important to have, not just with your physician, but in particular with the nurses on your healthcare team. The nurses are especially well-trained and very adept at understanding toxicity and at figuring out how to remediate that toxicity in a way that works to your benefit. So don't be ashamed or embarrassed. It's not a matter of heroism or bravado. Just have an open dialogue with your healthcare team, and especially the nurses when you have side effects. And you may be surprised to learn that the nurses and the docs may not get the management of that side effect perfectly right the first time. They may have to titrate and refine that supportive care therapy, but they will do it and they will work hard. And in the majority of cases, the team is usually very successful at trying to manage those types of side effects. And I discuss all that as a prelude to thinking about what's on the horizon. And really, as I and my colleagues travel around the world to various meetings talking about what's on the horizon, it would take me several hours to share with you all of the exciting new things that are on the horizon. And I'll just touch on a couple of them. I'll first touch by mentioning that there is, in the management of indolent lymphomas, a big move around the world to try to get away from chemotherapy. And that's really good news for patients, their family, and the physicians. Many of the drugs that are being developed today are actually oral. They're very well-tolerated drugs that you take orally by mouth with a glass of water. They don't require IV infusions. That's not to say we aren't developing novel drugs that are not chemotherapy that happen to be IV administered, but many of these new drugs tend to be oral. In the management of indolent lymphomas, there are a variety of new drugs out that now more precisely target the underlying biology of the disease and have fewer effects against the normal cells of your body. So some of those drugs include agents like the BTK inhibitor. BTK inhibitors BTK stands for Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitor. This is a pill that was recently approved for the treatment of mantle cell and chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And even in patients who've seen lots and lots of chemotherapy, this pill is able to produce major remissions, if not complete remissions, in patients with very, very chemotherapy-resistant disease. And until you see it happen, you almost don't believe it. But it is really a remarkable breakthrough in the treatment of not just mantle cell and CLL, but it's going to turn out a variety of other indolent lymphomas. There's a number of new drugs on the horizon, including agents called PI3 kinase inhibitors, and this one particular drug called idelalisib that targets this very specific protein or enzyme in the tumor cells. This particular enzyme is known to be highly, the gene for it is known to be one of the most commonly mutated genes in all of oncology. And this new drug, an oral drug, has been shown to have really remarkable effects in patients with CLL and indolent lymphomas, and a number of clinical studies have been conducted that have looked at PI3 kinase inhibitors now in combination with rituximab and bendamustine, all in a hope to try to improve the results of those standard therapies and eventually pave the way for therapies that don't require chemotherapy. Another area that I think is very, very exciting is the development of what are known as antibody-drug conjugates. And these drugs take advantage of the biology that you're already familiar with drugs like Rituxan, which are designed to specifically home into and target the tumor cell directly. In the case of Rituxan, it targets CD20. But now if you think of the Rituxan not just as the therapeutic agent, but think of it as a vehicle on which you can put a whole variety of other molecules that may be very toxic that the antibody allows to be drawn directly into the tumor cell proper and deliver that chemotherapy only to the tumor cell. One such drug that's been approved that fits this model is a drug called brentuximab vedotin, recently approved for Hodgkin's disease and T-cell lymphomas. And in the case of T-cell lymphomas, this one drug in patients that have disease resistant to chemotherapy has a response rate of over 80%, which is really quite remarkable. And now, over the next several years, you're going to see a whole variety of these new kinds of antibody drug conjugates that will be coming along, where the antibody will be nothing more than a vehicle that will help deliver really high concentrations of a particular kind of toxic drug or chemotherapy drug only to the tumor, and in that way limit your body's total exposure to the toxic or chemotherapy-based drug. So all I did for the last 10-15 minutes was really touch on some broad thematic areas, talking about the real value of clinical trials in taking care of patients. And for whatever skepticism or hesitancy you might have, I think information is the key to try to understand it and help achieve a comfort level that will be useful so that you can actually derive as much benefit from as possible from the many clinical trials that are happening, and recognize that you're always the boss. It's your discretion that we pay attention to, and it's you that we're trying to help. So please don't ever hesitate to express your desires, your intent to the healthcare team in terms of your wishes to stay on or come off a clinical trial. And really, with the plethora of new drugs that are being developed, the future for the management of this disease has never looked better. And I think it's incumbent on every patient now to become very informed about the options for their disease, to seek those who really are specialized in the management of the disease, because those are the people that are going to be conducting the trial, and to never hesitate to communicate with your healthcare team, because at the end of the day, that communication is what's going to serve your best interest for the future management of the disease. So with that, I'll thank you so much for your attention, and I'll turn it back over to Carolyn.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Dr. O'Connor. That was an excellent presentation, just a very informative, and very informative about clinical trials and also about the communication piece and what's new on the horizon. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Rick Dickens. Richard Dickens is an oncology social worker. He's clinical supervisor, mind-body project coordinator at Cancer Care. And Mr. Dickens is going to address the Cancer Care's free psychosocial services provided by our professionally trained oncology social workers and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Mr. Dickens.
Thanks, Carolyn. I'm going to start by expanding on what Dr. Press and Dr. O'Connor, their references to the importance of your healthcare team. It's central, and from a social work viewpoint, it really is imperative in getting proper care and holistic care. Building relationships with all members of your healthcare team is important, especially with a chronic cancer like indolent NHL. This usually includes a nurse, doctors, social worker, and other professionals. it's helpful to think of this as a partnership or collaboration. They are your primary health network and experts in your cancer and treatment, but you are the expert of your body and life, so it is important to let them know when you have a question. It is also important to build a personal support network of family and friends from your neighborhood and community, and your community center or house of worship. For many patients, it is hard to say, I need help. But for people who care about you, helping is one thing they can give. That is why with a chronic illness, building a support network is so important. By reaching out to as many as possible, you help the caregivers to spread the help and thereby help themselves as well. Accepting changes are normal during treatment contributes toward nurturing your body and spirit, but stressors can elicit feelings of sadness and frustration. What is happening to the patient can make family and friends feel helpless and scared as well. This is when it is helpful to seek help of a social worker or other professionals from organizations such as Cancer Care. Cancer Care has oncology social workers who inform people of resources and strategies for finding help, which can include creating a phone tree, or for those who are computer savvy, a blog to keep people informed, or mind-body-spirit techniques such as meditation and imagery to calm the mind and relax the body during stress. Along with education and resources, Cancer Care provides limited financial assistance, counseling, professional face-to-face groups, and national telephone and online groups for patients and for their loved ones. While individual counseling can be very helpful, many patients and caregivers want to speak with others who are going through the same thing. I speak to many people who say, I want to talk to someone else who is dealing with this and find out how they are coping and what resources they found, as well as be with others who really know what I am going through. Groups provide just that, bringing people together who are dealing with a similar crisis. Groups can provide role models, emotional support, coping strategies, and validation you're not alone. At Cancer Care, all of our groups, face-to-face, online, and phone, are professionally run and facilitated by oncology social workers, but it is the personal stories of each member that provides the insights, strength, and hope to get through a crisis like cancer. To many social supports, getting to know your healthcare team and support groups go a long way in helping to confront the different and difficult challenges of cancer. And daunting as they are, with help, they are never impossible. You can call a Cancer Care social worker at 1-800-813-HOPE and speak to one to explore how we can best help. I wish you all the best. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you very much, Rick, for that excellent presentation. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Danielle to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to try to take as many questions as possible. And if we don't get to your question, please call us at Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE. And I'll repeat that number again toward the end of the call. But for now, let's see if we can't take as many of your questions as possible. So, Danielle, could you bring our speakers on board and explain to the audience how to queue up for questions? Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And our first question comes from Vilma C. Your line is now open.
I was diagnosed with indolent non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in 2009, marginal stage 1. In the beginning, I was getting PET scans, but there seems to be a problem now with my insurance company. I'm a little concerned. Isn't a PET scan more reliable than a CT scan?
Well, that's an excellent question. Thank you. And indeed, in addition to your asking that question, there is a question from someone online also about what is the standard of care for the frequency of CAT scans with NHL, so with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So, Dr. Press, could you address this in a general way and helpful and help this caller and the other callers?
Sure. It's an excellent question, and a lot of the experts don't agree on the answers. I was just 2 days in Philadelphia where the National Cancer Center Network Guidelines team was discussing this issue. The two main imaging modalities for lymphoma are either CAT scans or PET scans. CAT scans measure the size of lymph nodes, whereas PET scans measure their metabolic activity, how fast they're growing. And PET scans are essential for aggressive lymphomas and Hodgkin's lymphomas, particularly at initial staging at the end of treatment. They're also quite good for follicular lymphoma. But they are less reliable, frankly, for marginal zone lymphoma, which is the type that you have. Even for aggressive and Hodgkin's lymphoma, the guidelines do not recommend routine surveillance with PET scans. They recommend CAT scans for routine surveillance, and that's why a lot of the insurance companies are proposing denials in those situations. So usually PET scans are used at initial diagnosis and at end of treatment, but CAT scans are preferred for routine monitoring and surveillance. And the frequency is undergoing a lot of debate. Right now, for indolent lymphomas, it's recommended they be done no more than every 6 months for the first 2 years after treatment. And then after that, some doctors would not do them at all, and others would do them no more frequently than once a year.
Thank you. Excellent. And our next question, Danielle?
Our next question is from Carmen R. Your line is open.
Yes, I just completed 6 months of Rituxan and Treanda therapy for follicular non-Hodgkin's. And my question is, once I have a PET scan done in November to see where we're at, how is it based as far as what is used to determine if the maintenance therapy is necessary or required for the Rituxan?
Well, thank you for that question. Dr. Press, could you answer that in a general way or in a way that would
yeah.
help?
So I'm going to rephrase the question. Basically, what do we do when we're done with giving in what we call induction therapy, in this case, bendamustine and rituximab? And there are three choices, and they're all acceptable choices. The first choice is to do nothing more, just to watch and wait and monitor the patient. The second choice is to give maintenance rituximab, which usually means giving an infusion of rituximab every 2 to 3 months for 2 years and then stopping. And the third option is to consolidate with radio-labeled antibodies, also known as radioimmunotherapy, and the only marketed product now is Zevalin. And it's been shown that the duration of remission will be longer with either maintenance rituximab or with consolidation radiolabeled antibody therapy, and the time to next treatment will be longer, often by years, but that the overall survival, how long a patient lives, isn't impacted. So it's acceptable to not do anything at the end of chemo. Other people who would rather go more years before getting treated can get maintenance rituximab, but that does mean more visits into the doctor. Or you can get a one-time radio-labeled antibody treatment, but there are some risks with the radiation. So any of those are acceptable. We're more likely to do maintenance and consolidation if the end of treatment scans do not show a complete remission.
Thank you. And we have a question from one of our online participants. Are there lab tests that can type the cancer cells of NHL so that chemotherapy can be tailored or targeted to a specific patient? Dr. Press, could you address that?
Yeah, not really. I mean, people are doing that. Probably at least half of the clinical trials and laboratory efforts are trying to do that, where we define the specific molecular mutations and then pick the very best drugs for that particular patient. And there are some cancers where that's being done already, including, you know, lung cancer, some forms of breast cancer, et cetera. In lymphoma, there are efforts and theories, but not proven personalized molecular therapies. But that is coming in the next few years, but I would say we're still in the infancy there.
So it's kind of it's a question that comes up in a lot of other cancers, but it's still in this area developing, is that what you'd say? Or
yes, it's a good question. It's a direction, the future is that we're moving in the future, but today, in June of 2014, we do not have tailored individual treatments based on molecular mutations.
Thank you. And we have another question from one of our online participants. I was just diagnosed with NHL. Will I be able to work, exercise, and perform my usual activities? Dr. Press, could you start with that question?
It depends on the treatment, really, but in most cases, people can continue, particularly with the treatments we use in indolent lymphomas. They can generally continue to work or to go to school. They will, of course, have to take time off to go to doctor visits and to get infusions, which in some cases can take up most of a day. And sometimes people feel rocky the day after a chemo treatment, may have nausea or vomiting. So I think there will be some time off from work and school, but most of the patients I treat, about 90%, continue to do those things. We do encourage exercise. Patients actually survive better and do better if they continue to do moderate exercise. But we don't expect people to go for personal bests or world records, and the word moderate is important when we talk about exercise.
And Carolyn, I'd like to jump in and just confirm.
I was just going to ask you to comment, yes.
Yeah, what Dr. Press said, definitely. In my 17 years in oncology, it is interesting that more and more studies have been done about exercise. And as Dr. Press said, you want to work with your healthcare team and moderate exercise. You're not going to go for world records. But it's showing that it actually is beneficial to exercise and be more active. I've worked in the beginning 17 years ago, people were much more debilitated, and definitely in the last 10 years, I work with many people, especially with blood cancers like NHL, who do maintain a fairly normal lifestyle. And even those in treatment with many of the new advances in terms of treatment side effects, nausea and white cells, people are maintaining a fairly good activities at work. And because cancer is being spoken about more and more nationally in the news and such and the workplace issues, I have seen a shift in more and more employers often being very accommodating. Not all the time, and it is something you really should talk to a professional about how you introduce it if you are in a workplace. But there is the Americans with Disabilities Act that does provide some options in making accommodations while you're in treatment. And more and more employers, I'm finding among my people I work with, are accommodating for a lot of patients who are in active treatment.
Well, those are excellent points. And there are two pieces of federal legislation. One is the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the second is the Family Medical Leave Act. And indeed, it is good to talk with, and I would really encourage you to talk to the healthcare team before you present, talk to your people at work, your supervisor or your HR person, that you really kind of get all the information you need, and even talk to one of our social workers as well, so that you're in a really good place to request if you need some flex time at work or something like that. It's really important to understand that you do have some legal protections around that as well. So it's an important question, and thank you for having asked it. Now, there's another question that we have. For a chemotherapy patient with normal calcium, magnesium, and potassium levels, what can be done to control leg cramps? Dr. Press?
Good question. This comes up a lot, and I think that we don't always have a satisfactory answer. The first thing is to check that the electrolytes, as just mentioned, calcium, magnesium, potassium, are all normal. And if they are, then we often try a medicine that, like baclofen, which is kind of a muscle relaxant and helps many people. Sometimes we have to resort to pain medications. And sometimes an anti-anxiety medicine, it's just kind of relaxes people, like lorazepam, can be useful.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have another question, Danielle.
And our next question comes from Ms. Ann P. Your line is now open.
I would like to ask a question of one of the physicians. I was diagnosed with follicular lymphoma stage 4 in 2004. Since that time, I have been on Rituxan maintenance. And one of the problems that I have is a perineoplastic syndrome, that is polymyositis. Is this, and then I've recently been diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, which kind of makes my symptoms so to treat. Is this a common occurrence, the paraneoplastic syndrome?
Well, thank you for that question. Dr. Press, can you address that?
Your comments broke up a little bit there, but I think the question is, you've been on Rituxan since 2004. Usually we wouldn't leave somebody continuously on rituximab that long, but I don't know the details of your cases. Usually we give, the data are really for 2 years of maintenance Rituxan. There are studies now looking at 2 versus 5 years to see which is better. The trouble with prolonging rituximab maintenance forever is that people can develop suppression of their normal immune system to the point where they get recurrent infections or other problems, and so that's generally not recommended outside of a clinical trial. Now, whether the paraneoplastic syndrome that you're having is related to that or not, I think is speculative. That's not a real common problem. And rituximab is actually a treatment for rheumatoid arthritis that's moderately effective. So I don't think it's causing the rheumatoid arthritis.
And thank you for that. And we certainly advise you to go back to treating healthcare team and ask them about this as well with this information that you've received today. And we have another question. I was diagnosed with stage 4B cell NHL about 2 years ago. The type of NHL cannot be diagnosed because of I have no swelling in my lymph nodes, so a biopsy is not feasible. You said the most important step is to find out what type of NHL you have. What is the most important first step in my case?
So this brings up, you can have lymphoma in many tissues, and it's far and away most common in lymph nodes, but can be other places like the bone marrow or the liver or other sites. It's harder to make a definitive diagnosis of the subtype if the lymph nodes are not involved because the patterns look different. But there are other tests that can help us, particularly a test called flow cytometry, looking at the kinds of molecules on the surface of the cells. That can be done on bone marrow or other tissues or blood. There is a test called immunohistochemistry, in which, they, again, by a different technique, they look at the molecules that are on the cell or in the cell. And thirdly, there are cytogenetics, which is basically looking at the chromosome changes, the gene mutations. And each of the subtypes of lymphoma have different patterns of molecules on the cell surface, inside the cell, and different mutations that are associated with them. So even without a lymph node biopsy, it's often possible to make a very good educated guess about the subtype based on those studies.
Excellent. And there's another question. The excellent questions here are from our online participants, from Diane. Is the use of radiation therapy for grade 1, stage 1 on Hodgkin's follicular lymphoma considered common practice now? My physicians do not seem in agreement due to side effects of radiation therapy. My primary site appears to be a neck node. If you could answer that in a general way.
Well, so the question is, if you are one of the 10 or 15% of patients who have just a single lymph node involvement and nothing else, the rest of the body, is local radiotherapy the treatment of choice? And the answer to that used to be a clear yes, and it still is the preferred treatment listed in the National Cancer Center Network guidelines for treatment of stage 1 follicular lymphoma. However, there are a lot of doctors now, based on recent non-randomized studies, who think that other acceptable management strategies are also acceptable. And studies have shown that giving rituximab and chemo may give somewhat longer remissions in some patients, even with stage 1. There's one study from Stanford that suggests if you just do watchful waiting, even in stage 1, that the outcome is as good as with radiation treatment. So where there used to be one answer and that answer was radiation therapy, there are now several acceptable answers, including radiation therapy, watchful waiting, rituximab and chemo. They are all accepted now. If you were to ask me what I would do if I had stage one, I would have local radiation. I still think that the longest data and the best data is with local radiation for stage one disease. And about 40 to 50% of the patients will never have a recurrence in their lifetime if given local radiation.
Well, thank you so much. That's excellent. And we have a question, another one, which will probably be our last question. It says, please discuss after effects of prophylactic Rituxan as related to development of allergies to environmental substances and food months, years after receiving Rituxan.
Well, that's a question to which there isn't a good answer. I mean, there, as I mentioned, if you get Rituxan, there can be certainly early side effects like fevers, chills, shakes, shortness of breath, et cetera, from what's called infusion reactions. There can be long-term side effects, as I mentioned, by suppressing the normal immune system. People can get infections. In theory, suppression of the normal immune system could also lead to other problems, but I'm not aware of any good data proving that it leads to allergies or food sensitivities.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank our speakers. You've really been extraordinary today, and it's just an amazing amazing program, and I really can't thank you enough for presenting on today's program and just the wealth of information that has been presented today. I also want to thank all of you who've queued up and asked such great questions, and I also want to thank all of you who've been listening. And I do remind all of you that this is a one-hour education program and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And with that in mind, I just want to remind you again of all the services that you can access from Cancer Care. Now, we have a wonderful oncology social workers here at Cancer Care, and they're available to talk with you to provide support and counseling. To OSLU, we offer online and telephone support groups as well, which people find very helpful. And we also offer these workshops on a regular basis on a variety of topics. And we have many publications and fact sheets, and we have a very robust website as well. So there are lots of things that we do here. We also offer practical and financial assistance to many people, so that there are many things that we offer here. You might consider it a menu of services, and you can access the services that would be most helpful to you. And they are all free, so there's no cost for the services. And because you can call us by phone or contact us via the web, there are no geographic barriers to reaching us as well, and to some extent no time barriers either. So please do keep this in mind. Again, if you have a question that you didn't get to ask today or that comes up for you in the next couple of days or weeks, or if you have some concerns about either workplace issues or concerns about talking with your children about your lymphoma or actually concerns about your treatment or communicating with your healthcare team, please do contact us at Cancer Care. And we are, again, simply a telephone call away at 1-800-813-HOPE. Most importantly, we don't want anyone to conclude this program today thinking that they are alone. We want you to know that you're part of a community of support, and we're here to help you. So please do contact us, and we will look forward to being of help to all of you. Thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.